Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Getting into a war requires huge resources, large numbers of highly trained people with a wide range of special skills, and most importantly, a clear and well-executed strategy. Getting out of a war requires the same things. But in the final days of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, the lack of an exit strategy became abundantly, tragically clear. Tens of thousands of South Vietnamese who had collaborated with their American allies found themselves in great danger as the North Vietnamese army closed in on Saigon. Most had reason to fear their families were also in jeopardy. But the U.S. government had failed to formulate a plan for the orderly evacuation of these vulnerable people. That left a small number of American military and diplomatic officials remaining at the end with the monumental task of getting the most endangered South Vietnamese out of the country and few resources and precious little time to do it. Director Rory Kennedy documents the story in her Oscar-nominated film Last Days in Vietnam. Kevin McAllister is the producer. The doc airs as an American Experience special April 28th on KERA Channel 13 television, and we are glad to have both of my guests here to talk about it. Welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having us.
What had happened between the Paris Peace Accords early in 1973 and April of 1975 when the evacuation of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon finally took place?
Well, with the Paris Peace Accords in 1973, we basically established a peace between North and South Vietnam. And with that, the American troops had withdrawn from Vietnam. So by April of 1975, which is really the focus of our documentary, there were no more military American troops in Vietnam. There were a handful of about 6,000 or 7,000 personnel who were there to help the peace, Marines and other folks at the embassy. We had an ambassador there. So that when the events took place where North came into South Vietnam, the country toppled much faster than anybody expected. Most people thought, well, you know, if they were going to get to Saigon, it might take 2 years. It ended up taking 4 months. And the Americans were really caught off guard. We didn't have a proper evacuation plan. And that contributed to the chaos that took place during those final days.
Yeah, by the time April 1975 was happening and it became clear how bad things would be, there wasn't a perfect option anymore for withdrawal.
That's correct. And there was actually, as the invasion went on, there were increasingly few options, even for evacuating the Americans in country and the at-risk South Vietnamese, so-called at-risk South Vietnamese, meaning the people that had collaborated with us during our time there, translators, counterparts of American military men. And so it all unfolded really over the course of 6 or 7 weeks in March and April 1975.
President Ford in 1975 called the fall of Da Nang a tragedy unbelievable in its ramifications, but he was unable to convince Congress to fund a $722 million emergency assistance package designed to get endangered South Vietnamese and even Americans out safely. Let's listen here to former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger.
When President Ford went before the Congress, he had two major concerns. The first was to save as many people as we could. He cared for the human beings involved. They were not just pawns that once they had lost their military power were abandoned. The second was the honor of America, that we would not be seen at the final agony of South Vietnam as having stabbed it in the back.
That was former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger speaking in Last Days in Vietnam, the documentary that airs as an American Experience special April 28th on KERA. The country, though, at this point was just over the war. Did average citizens simply no longer care what happened when we left?
You know, I think it's important to remember the context in which Congress decided not to support that package. And I think that you're heading in that direction, which is that, you know, as a country, we had spent many years in Vietnam. 58,000 Americans had died in Vietnam. Many millions of Vietnamese had died in the war. And there wasn't a lot to show for it. And the idea of getting back involved in the war after we had really withdrawn our troops, I think, wasn't really a viable option in our country at that point. Congress, the majority of Congress at that point had been elected because they had taken an anti-war stance. And I think we were interested in moving on. I'm not sure I would kind of simplify it to say that we didn't care about the Vietnamese. I don't think there was really a recognition of the implications of not having an evacuation policy. And I'm not sure that's the responsibility of the American citizens to have that level of awareness of what the implications might be. And frankly, my own personal opinion is that, you know, the $722 million at that point was too little too late, you know, unless we were really willing to get back into that war in a significant way. I think it would have made a some difference. I think that, you know, part of the issue with the chaos that took place during those final days is that we didn't have a proper evacuation plan in place. We didn't have a list of here are the people who are at highest risk, they should get out first. Here are the people at a little bit lesser risk, they should get out next. It wasn't methodical. But I'm not sure even the $722 million would have made a difference in that.
The U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, Graham Martin, at the time, is a truly fascinating character in this story. He simply could not initially make himself believe that an evacuation would actually be necessary.
Yes, Rory and I and my co-writer Mark Bailey talked about the ambassador in depth while we were making this film, because he is such a complex character. He seemed torn between not wanting to give the public the impression that the South Vietnamese government might falter, but he also seemed incapable of distinguishing between that very public stance and the private necessity of planning and leading an evacuation should the worst occur, which in fact it did. I think he also tended not to believe what the CIA was telling him about the prospects for the South Vietnamese government, which were slim even before the invasion of Da Nang. And after Da Nang fell, it seemed the tragedy was accelerating rapidly. Earlier when Rory said that, you know, people seemed to think that it would take 2 years, the North Vietnamese government itself thought it would take 2 years, and they had planned it as a two-year campaign where they would sort of make incursions in early 1975, retreat the wet season, and then return in early 1976. But they sort of ran through the Central Highlands so quickly and got to Da Nang that half of the country was effectively lost in the space of just over 3 weeks. At that point, even then, the ambassador dragged his feet about planning an evacuation. And much of the evacuation you see in the film was put into place and planned after Congress refused the $722 million, because buried in that bill was, I think, something like $250 million for humanitarian assistance and for evacuation. So, you know, Martin was at the very far end of optimistic about what would happen, and ended up being a huge problem for not only the Americans in Vietnam, but our South Vietnamese allies.
What finally pushed Martin to realize it was game over in Vietnam?
Well, on the evening of April 28th, the airport in Saigon had been bombed. And by the North. And that, up to that point, had been the primary evacuation route in the planning that had taken place, that if we needed to greenlight an evacuation, it would go out of the airport. And that was then bombed. And the North said, you now have 24 hours to get out of here. And so at that point, it became abundantly clear that there were no more choices available. But even then, Ambassador Martin insisted on actually going to the airport himself to evaluate the bombing and to assess as to whether we really needed to close down the airport and really needed to greenlight the evacuation. And so he went there, and indeed he came to that conclusion. And at that point, they then needed to really change the evacuation point from the airport to the embassy and resorted to what was the fourth option, which was a helicopter airlift, which nobody really wanted to do because helicopters are so small and time-consuming, and it creates a much more difficult strategic approach to trying to get people out of the country. But at that point, you know, Ambassador Martin did make the call to the president and to Kissinger to say, we need to start this evacuation and we have 24 hours to do it.
We're speaking this hour with director Rory Kennedy and producer Kevin McAllister. Their Oscar-nominated documentary Last Days in Vietnam will air as an American Experience special April 28th on KERA Channel 13 television. Tonight at 6:20, during All Things Considered, we will hear the story of a South Vietnamese colonel imprisoned for 13 years after the war, part of the KERA Voices series Remembering the Vietnam War.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
Just heard Bing Crosby singing White Christmas. We'll find out why in just a moment. We're speaking this hour with director Rory Kennedy and producer Kevin McAllister of the film Last Days in Vietnam. The Oscar-nominated documentary will air on American Experience April 28th on KERA Channel 13 television. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Listening to that, it's sort of chilling to think about what hearing that over the radio meant to the people who understood the secret message in April of 1975.
Thank you, yes. So in 1975, there was a haphazard evacuation plan developed by the U.S. Embassy in the roughly 10 days between Congress voting against a $722 million aid package to South Vietnam and the fall of the country on April 29th, 30th, to the North Vietnamese. And one of the main elements of this evacuation plan, because this was the time before cell phones, obviously. In fact, while we were making the film, Richard Armitage, who was one of the subjects that we interviewed, was talking about a flash message that one of the ship's captain sent back to the Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, and he said it took 20 minutes for that flash message to get back, which is the fastest they could send it. So in order to quickly let the Americans in Saigon at the time know that the evacuation was happening, they came up with the signal. And the signal was, when Armed Forces Radio played White Christmas by Bing Crosby, you knew that the evacuation was on.
So there is this plan to get people out from the embassy in helicopters, which, you know, if you think about it, is kind of like emptying a bathtub with a teaspoon over and over. And they would be taken to waiting U.S. ships offshore, but there were also some Vietnamese vessels, because there were a lot of Vietnamese whose lives were in great jeopardy as the North Vietnamese army approached, right?
That's correct. And, you know, that's the great tragedy of this story, is that so many of the South Vietnamese who had worked with the Americans and who had risked their lives over the years really ended up paying the price for the fact that we didn't have an evacuation plan in place. You know, the Americans were able to get out during those final days and weeks, but there were so many of our South Vietnamese allies who were left behind, people who worked with us as translators, cooks. They worked inside the embassy. Some of them worked with the CIA undercover. Some of them worked as military people, military personnel, and they all faced greater vulnerability because of their connection to the Americans. And, you know, we were able to get many people out during those final days, and our story really focuses on that and reveals some really extraordinary moments of both Americans and South Vietnamese who risked their jobs for sure and arguably risked their lives to save as many South Vietnamese as possible. And there's some really inspiring stories within this period of time, but of course it's in the larger context that the film, I think, focuses on as well, of the tragedy of all those folks who were in fact left behind.
What were they afraid would happen to them, and what in fact did happen to those who might have been airlifted out but weren't able to get on one of those helicopters?
Well, I think the great fear was that they would be killed, that they would be tortured, that they would end up in the what were called re-education camps, where people were forced to endure hard labor for many, many years, sometimes well over a decade. And that, in fact, did play itself out for many of the South Vietnamese. Many, many people were killed during this time. Others were tortured, and others were left in these re-education camps that was, you know, where many, many died as well.
You have some truly astonishing footage taken aboard the USS Kirk. Can you talk about how you came across that and how it informed the way you were able to tell the story?
Well, the Kirk was a ship that was out in the South China Sea, and it was basically between the fleet, which was further out in the South China Sea, and protecting it in case there was any incoming fire. And, you know, as you had suggested earlier, what was happening was there were helicopters going from the fleet to the embassy, picking up people from the embassy, both South Vietnamese and Americans, and bringing them back to the fleet. And so the ship, the USS Kirk, was protecting in case there was any incoming fire. What ended up happening is, as the American helicopters were heading towards the fleet, the South Vietnamese Air Force had disintegrated, but there were still Air Force pilots, South Vietnamese Air Force pilots, and they still had access to their helicopters. So what many of them ended up doing is getting in their helicopters and filling them to the rim with as many family members and friends as possible. So these helicopters, these little Huey helicopters that were meant for three or four or five people, would be filled with 13, 14, 15 people. And they started chasing the fleet, chasing the American helicopters out to the fleet. And the first ship that they came across often was the USS Kirk. And the USS Kirk didn't know who these people were, what they were. They saw, you know, these little blips on a radar screen. Then they looked up and there were these little Huey helicopters hovering above them. The captain of the Kirk, Captain Jacobs, took the courageous decision to call the first helicopter down. They didn't know exactly if it was enemy or friend, but he had the instincts that it was friend. They called him down, and 13 people climbed out of this Huey helicopter, South Vietnamese, were incredibly grateful to be there. And then what happens is there are all of these other helicopters hovering above, but the Kirk, which was not meant for this mission, didn't have room for more than one helicopter. So the people on board, the sailors, said to the captain, "What do we do with this helicopter? What do we do about the people hovering above?" And the captain said, "Throw that helicopter overboard. Let's make room for the next one." So there's this extraordinary footage of these sailors taking this helicopter and pushing it over the side of the ship so that the next helicopter can come down. And, you know, we were lucky enough to get some footage of this as well as some other really extraordinary moments that take place over the course of the film. I ended up talking to a fellow at a party who worked with the U.S. Navy and telling him I wanted to focus on the story of the Kirk. And it turned out that he had talked to a sailor who had been on the Kirk 4 months prior and had mentioned that he had gone up into his attic and came across a box of untransferred footage, Super 8 footage from the Kirk during this time. And so I tracked him down and ended up flying him out to California where I lived and was making the film, and we transferred the footage, and it was a treasure trove. So so that footage is included in the film. We use about 12 minutes of his footage in the film, which if you know documentaries, that's an extraordinary portion of footage.
Let's listen here to Mickey Gwen, who was 6 years old when his father flew a Chinook helicopter as close as possible to a U.S. ship.
One by one, we jump out. I jumped out. My brother jumped out. My mom was holding my sister. Obviously, very scared. And she just, you know, just trustingly, just with one hand, with her right hand, holding on with her left to brace herself, you know, just dropped my baby sister.
One fella standing there, and he said he looked up and he saw this big bundle of stuff come flying out, and it was a baby. It was the one-year-old baby. And then the mother jumped out, and he caught her too. Then the pilot flew out on our starboard right side. He hovered with his wheels in and out of the water. He hovered there for like 10 minutes, and we couldn't figure out what he was doing. It turned out what he was doing was taking his flight suit off. And here's a man flying a twin rotor helicopter by himself at the same time he's taking off a flight suit. How you do it, I've talked to helicopter pilots, and they can't figure out how he did that. You know, how, like a Houdini trying to get out of this thing. And finally, he made the helicopter roll to the right as he stepped out the door on the left.
Just thunderous, loud noise. The shrapnel is just blowing up. Suddenly, just quiet. And he pops up, and he's alive.
It's an amazing story.
It is such an extraordinary moment.
I'm wondering, you know, this is such a confusing, big thing. Communication in the moment was really difficult. You have all these different sources. What were the challenges of making sure you had enough people remembering things in a similar enough way that you could use these accounts in the film?
Well, you know, there were many, many stories that we didn't end up including in the film.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Academy Award-winning, award-nominated documentary Last Days in Vietnam will be airing on KERA Channel 13 television and PBS stations across the country April 28th as a part of American Experience. We're speaking this hour with its producer, Kevin McAllister, and director, Rory Kennedy. And Rory, we had a little bit of technical difficulty, but you were telling us that there were stories, many stories that you discovered in the process of doing research that you weren't able to use, and you were telling us how you decided which ones you would use.
Well, one of the things that excited me about this story is the fact that I think so many people don't actually know what happened during those final days. And it's been an interesting phenomenon in having this film come out theatrically and being at film festivals over the course of the last year, where I would say the dominant response has been, I can't believe we don't know this story. And that was my response to it in researching it and learning more about the details of it. There was so much I didn't know. And so much of it, and this kind of very inherently dramatic moment take place within a 24-hour period in Saigon. And so we really ended up focusing our story on what happened during those last 24 hours. And we had various stories that all converged during that period of time. And so the film is really told, I think, like a ticking clock, what's going to happen next. And you have these characters in different scenarios who are all facing great challenges. There's no narrator in the film. There are no historians looking back or who are providing more information or insight than our characters have as the events unfold. And I think because of that, people watch this film and they say, you know, over and over again, gosh, I was at the edge of my seat. What was going to happen next? And so we ended up structuring the story a bit to accommodate that and to really, you know, when we read about the story, it was so dramatic. We wanted that to be translated for the audience, and so chose our stories geographically so they really take place in Saigon. We chose them so that they would culminate during those last 24 hours. And so, you know, we made decisions both based on story and kind of how to tell a documentary that I think is compelling and engaging, but also that kind of revealed this reality and truth that I think people really weren't aware of, both in terms of just the bones of the story of what happened and also these extraordinary dramatic moments of Americans and South Vietnamese who really risked everything to try to save as many South Vietnamese as possible.
We do definitely have this sense that people, on the American side were doing as much as they could. Here's U.S. Army Colonel Stuart Harrington talking about really his anguish at the end, having done what he could and having to, basically sneak away, knowing that there were people still trusting that they would be taken care of, but that they simply couldn't get to these ships that were waiting offshore.
I thought about how this really, really was wrong. I thought maybe I should just say, I'm not leaving till they go, because I promised them. And then I said, don't be a fool. Maybe they've started shooting down helicopters for all you know. You're not going to get anybody else out. It's a presidential order. This decision has been made. So I got to the roof and a CH-46 alighted on the rooftop. Put its ramp down, and we got on board. As it took off, the door was open. And down in the parking lot, I could see the group of 420 of them. They were right where we had left them marshaled on this little patch of grass. I felt absolutely awful. It was just so serious and deep a betrayal.
Again, that was U.S. Army Colonel Stuart Harrington in the documentary Last Days in Vietnam. What I think is so fascinating about that particular portion of the interview is that there's a great deal for Harrington and his colleagues to be proud of, and yet they carry with them this sense that it should have worked better. They should have been able to do more.
It's really an extraordinary thing, I think. And part of that moment in the film is, you know, it is so much on Colonel Harrington's shoulders, and he is on the forefront of American policy. And yet, as Americans, I think we haven't taken it on, and it really is our collective responsibility. So I think part of the film is to help us understand, you know, what happens at the end of a war, and what is our responsibility to the people who are left behind, and what are we exposing our troops to and the decisions they're having to make on the front lines of these wars. And to take some of that responsibility back, I think, to both the politicians and the military personnel who are actually making the decisions that are playing themselves out with people like Colonel Harrington, but also as Americans, so that we really, I think, have a deeper appreciation of the implications of war and what happens at the end of the war, of a war. And I think it brings, you know, raises important questions about Iraq and Afghanistan and other challenges we're facing today. But I wanted to add a kind of nice anecdote to that moment in the film. One of the people that Colonel Harrington leaves behind is a guy named Binh Pho, a South Vietnamese. He was a student at the time and somebody who we ended up interviewing him. And he was one of the 420 people who was in the embassy who had been assured that they would get out, that they were on American soil. Colonel Harrington had promised this young man that he would get him out. And then he was, in fact, left behind, as that moment reveals. And when the film got nominated for an Academy Award, we were obviously all very excited. And one of the things that then happens is you have to try to figure out how to get tickets to the actual Academy Award, because it's very hard even if you're nominated. So anyway, we were able to get a number of tickets. So I extended an invitation to Colonel Harrington to join us at the Academy Awards, who was the man you just heard from who had left the people. And I also extended an invitation to Binh Pho, who was one of the 420 people left behind. And when I called Ben and told him that Colonel Harrington would be coming, as well as various members of the crew and whatnot, he was very excited. And then he paused and he said, you know, who would have thought 40 years ago when I was left at the embassy by Colonel Harrington that we would be going to the Oscars together and walking down the red carpet.
What was it like when they met?
Well, that's an interesting story that actually preceded us, and Colonel Harrington was the one who introduced us to Binh Pho. Binh Pho had told a friend about what had happened to him, and he said, well, you should track down that guy who left you there, see what's happened to him. And Binh Pho said, well, I wouldn't even begin to know how to do that. And his friend said, well, let's Google him. And so they Googled him and found out that he lived in San Diego. And he said, here's his phone number. Call him up. And he found it immediately. Anyway, so it took Binh Pho a couple weeks to kind of muster up the courage to call him. And he ended up calling him and they had lunch together. And it was a sweet moment. And they both came to Sundance when the film premiered there, and there was a wonderful moment at Sundance where they came up along with 10 or 11 other people who had been in the film, and they participated in the Q&A with us, and Colonel Harrington talked about how guilty he felt and how he lived in fear of running into one of these 420 people his whole life. And then Binh Pho took the microphone and he said, Stu, I want you to know I forgive you for leaving me behind. And It was a beautiful moment. There wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Have audiences been surprised that there is, I mean, we're so accustomed to sort of putting Vietnam in this bitter box of you know, poor decisions and deceptions. You can walk away from this film with at least some sense that American personnel on the ground really did extraordinary work and saved many lives.
Well, I think what struck us about this film was that it was, about the story rather, was that it was sort of concerned heroic men in unheroic circumstances. And we really wanted to avoid getting into sort of political discussions about how Vietnam fell or who bore responsibility, because I think our superficial conclusion was that there was enough responsibility to go around all the parties, South Vietnamese government, the American government, and obviously the North Vietnamese. And so in this sort of time of remote policy being dictated from Washington and to some extent by an imperious ambassador, it was left to the men on the ground who, you know, there's a moment in the film where one of the Marine security guards says, we couldn't control policy. We could just do what we could only do what we could reach out and touch. And I feel like that was the story that we found in the film.
Kevin McAllister is producer of Last Days in Vietnam. Rory Kennedy directed it. The documentary airs as an American Experience special April 28th on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13 television. It's really been a pleasure to speak with both of you. Thank you so much for making time with us.
Thank you for having
Thanks
us.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. We really appreciate it. Thank you.